Excuse me. Cut. against the wall of the nightclub. It was coming up too close to dawn. When you looked at me, I thought that you would have it all. Think you're so fine, baby, I just wanna take you home. Then you came up close and something seemed to change my mind. Got to thinking that you are not the perfect guy. That shirt you're wearing makes me think that you are going blind. And your words are going nowhere.
Welcome to Hard Talk on the BBC World Service with me, Stephen Sacker. At the age of 19, my guest today made a fateful and in many ways unlikely decision which transformed her life. Back then in 2007, Manning was troubled, rebellious, jobless, sporadically homeless, and desperate to make a fresh start. The US Army was a strange choice, not least because to be openly gay or transgender was an offence under its don't ask, don't tell policy. But Manning had skills in computing and data analysis, which the military was very keen to use. Within 3 years, she was sent to Iraq at the height of the insurgency against the US occupation. Manning's job was to collate and interpret vast amounts of data and intelligence. It provided access to a vast store of confidential information about the US wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan, going back years. So Manning downloaded this intel trove and sent it anonymously to WikiLeaks. The material made global headlines around the world, embarrassing the US government and, according to the Pentagon, compromising vital security interests. Within months, Manning was arrested, imprisoned, and eventually put on trial, charged with 22 offences. The result, a 35-year prison sentence. Chelsea Manning fought a long battle to get her gender transition recognised whilst inside prison. President Obama gave her clemency in 2017, and she is now a digital activist and advocate for transparency and equality. Can transparency ever be a justification for spilling state secrets? Well, Chelsea Manning joins me now. Welcome to Hard Talk.
Thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure to have you. If I may, I want to begin with the decision that really changed, transformed your life. That is the decision to sign up to the US military.
Right.
Why did you do it?
So in 2007, My father and I had a falling out, and I was living in Maryland, and I had just been houseless for about a year. And I decided that, you know, working in various jobs and, you know, trying to go to school wasn't enough for me. And I also, as a trans person, I was trying to figure out who I was. And so I had a lot of identity issues, all sort of happening at the same time, you know, and wanting to rebuild my relationship with my father, who was in the Navy, and also this war being, you know, discussed continuously and ongoing. It was a dinner table conversation. The Iraq War at the time, as well as Afghanistan to a lesser extent, being an ongoing thing, I decided, based on my father sort of suggesting that I enlist in the Navy, I decided I wanted to be a little different and try to enlist in the Marine Corps. But the recruiters weren't there on that day, so I ended up enlisting in the U.S. Army.
Even within that story, there are all sorts of red flags to me, but
right.
Suggest that you're actually perhaps one of the most unsuitable people I could possibly think of to actually go and serve in the U.S. Army in Iraq. I mean, you talk about the wrestle with your identity, which we'll talk more
right.
about later, but also you'd been homeless for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You were very lost mentally. Your mental health was fragile. You had a poor relationship with your parents. On all of those bases, as well as being quite a rebellious person, the idea of going into uniform, accepting the authority of the U.S. Army, seems like the last thing you needed at that particular time.
Well, I mean, other people would make the suggestion that that's exactly what you need at that time. So, you know, then that was what my father was suggesting, and that's what the military itself was even suggesting.
But were you just really trying to escape from the reality of your life
sure.
as it was then?
Sure. I think that's why a lot of people at that age enlist in the military.
In your memoir, it's a very candid mm-hmm. memoir, and you describe how you really struggled with basic training, with lots of different aspects
right.
of being in the military. And in fact, the military nearly threw you out long before you got to Iraq, but you just about scraped through. And they recognized mm-hmm. in you some skills, particularly computing skills, data analysis skills,
right.
which they desperately needed at that particular time.
Right.
Do you think that they, in a sense, swallowed their major suspicions and reservations about you just because of the skills you brought to the table?
Sure. The U.S. military at that time frame, was very short-staffed. They were obviously trying, you know, one of the things to try to encourage people to enlist in the military at the time was they were offering these gigantic bonuses. I mean, I think it was offered $20,000, and some of my other peers were offered $40,000 at the time in order to enlist. There were people who were leaving the military and being called back up and, you know, to as a stop loss to continue to have people in the office. Many people in my position as well, you know, were basically having their sort of issues looked at, ignored or given a second chance or, you know, put into a slightly different role to sort of shake things up. Yeah.
Right. Because you were obviously destined to go to Iraq to do data analysis, to work in intel in one form or another.
Right.
You were warned, weren't you, about the dangers of leaking, of exposing information to the outside. You're also warned, I believe, about WikiLeaks in particular.
It was brought up I was brought up by a contractor, a civilian contractor who was training us. They mentioned it, and it was just sort of a thing in passing. I do recall that happening. I didn't really dig into it at that point. It was like 2008, so.
Right, you didn't dig into it, and yet within weeks of arriving in Iraq, you'd reached out to WikiLeaks, and you'd clearly made a decision to cross the most fundamental line of all, to actually reveal this confidential, secret information.
I don't think that comports with the timeline necessarily. I think that I spent, you know, quite a bit of time in my job and in my role, and obviously I was in various.
Well, I think by the end of November, you'd only arrived there a month or so earlier. By the end of November, you'd made the initial contact with WikiLeaks.
That doesn't comport with my understanding of the events now.
Well, it's the timeline that was put into the court, and that appeared to be established by the computer records.
That's not the timeline that I'm familiar with. So I recall the upload coming up in January, but the first time that I ever, you know, uploaded anything or released anything was in January.
Right. Well, yes, that's when you actually release things. I'm talking about the initial contact. But
let's
not quibble about a few weeks, because it doesn't really actually matter that much.
I think it matters because, you know, like I had some time to settle into my role. I had some time to really learn things and experience things.
So what was it that motivated you to cross that most fundamental line? In essence, to steal secrets and send them not just to anybody, but to WikiLeaks, where you knew they would be exposed to the whole world.
Well, I mean, I tried to reach out to the New York Times and the Washington Post as well. So, you know, this was one of the things that I envisioned was a sort of a physical handoff to, like, a journalist in, like, a kind of a Woodward and Bernstein-style handoff in parking garage or something along those lines. So that's why I went to the U.S. during my leave and tried to contact conventional journalists.
Right. In the end, you used a computer in a bookshop, I believe, to dispatch this information. And we should say vast, vast amounts of information. The so-called Iraq war logs and the Afghan war diaries amounted to hundreds of thousands of separate pieces of information, right?
Right. But, I mean, like, I worked with, you know, tens of millions of records every single day. So this is still even a fraction of, you know, the kinds of information that we were collecting and using.
I don't doubt that, but what I'm getting to is the point that as these were hundreds of thousands of files, there is no way in the world that you'd sifted them, filtered them. You just dumped them.
No, I wouldn't characterize it as that. The way that I view this is, you know, these are categorical types of information. So you have information that, and this is obviously types of information that I'm very familiar with, that I have worked that, you know, I was essentially one of the most familiar with because we were the ones that really had to categorize this information, put it into subcategories, you know, direct where it flows, train an artificial intelligence algorithm to, you know, to be able to make predictive analysis based on. So I think that I was very familiar, and I certainly knew tens of thousands of
types of information. And this was information going back 5 years to the engagements in Afghanistan and Iraq of the U.S. military. You knew the categories.
I think 6 years.
You knew the types, the categories. But what I'm getting to is you didn't go through these files to look at the individual stories they told. You couldn't possibly. There were far too many. We know you didn't. And that gets to the heart of the ethics of this case. You just put this information out there, gave it to WikiLeaks, not having examined it yourself, and not knowing that actually it did include some information which named individuals, which compromised individual security.
The U.S. government wasn't able to show, they didn't show that in court. So they made this allegation in 2010, but it appears that in 2011, whenever the Information Review Task Force reviewed this information, that it was a different type of information that I had access to that they included because they assumed that everything that I had access to was potentially leaked. But, you know, and I did have access to source identifying information, and I did have access to human intelligence reports, but those were not included in the records.
Right, but you see, once it was out there, and WikiLeaks in the end dumped this information into the public domain, because, of course, you had no control over what WikiLeaks, Julian Assange,
right,
and the rest of them were going to do with it. They chose, in the end, to dump this information
into
the
public domain.
If they hadn't,
then I would have done the same thing.
Would you?
I would have posted it.
And you say that now,
BitTorrent, or
knowing what we know. The media, for example, mm-hmm, went through this information. You know, this is back in July of 2010 when you did the first big dump, was put into the public domain. The Times newspaper found the names of dozens of Afghans credited with providing detailed intelligence to US forces. The Taliban then went on the record saying, we are analyzing all of this data and we will take retribution against those individuals that we find in this reporting from WikiLeaks.
Right.
Amnesty International and the Open Society Institute then said, we have seen the negative, sometimes deadly ramifications for those Afghans who have been identified. That was all your work.
Right. And again, you know, we went through a court-martial process and those allegations didn't show up. They made the allegation that, you know, obviously the Taliban said that they were going to retribute against people, and then the government couldn't identify anybody who was held accountable or...
So as far as you and your conscience are concerned, the fact that you don't, mm-hmm, know of specific individuals who were
We were given a list of individuals who were placed at risk. This just didn't happen.
Well, they clearly were placed at risk. Whether or not retribution was eventually delivered to those people is another matter.
But there's no list of names for us to go through. We asked for it during our court-martial.
But the media found these names. I mean, it was quite plain.
Well, wasn't presented before the court.
But even if it wasn't presented before the court, and I'm not answerable for what the prosecution did or didn't do,
right,
is it on your conscience that these names, you didn't sift the information. It turns out you did put names into the public domain. And I wonder now, having had many years to reflect on it, whether you regret that.
Well, no, I chose certain categories of information under the understanding of what is and should be in this kind of information.
Categories, yeah. Categories.
Categories,
yeah.
Yes.
In a sense, you put an awful lot of trust into WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. Do you regret that?
I would, if they were not available, I would have uploaded this information separately. I was in a position where if I didn't have a publisher of last resort, because I was struggling with the New York Times, I was struggling with the Washington Post. The Washington Post was the one that I really wanted to get to, and the one that I had the most sort of interaction with. Then I was going to, you know, use some other tool like BitTorrent or something like that to post this information, which would have been, that would have been my even more of a last resort. That would have been my more desperate.
Right. You did the war logs and the war diaries dump, and then you then released all of these diplomatic cables, which
had
different kinds of information, secret, confidential information involving the U.S. government's contacts with individuals on the ground,
yes,
and a whole host of countries. Just to take one small example, but not small to the individual involved, an Ethiopian journalist, reporter, Argu Ashin, was forced to flee the country because he was named in a US cable and he believed it put his life in immediate danger. He had to flee, leave his homeland. And again, wouldn't have happened had you not taken your decision to leave.
Again, you know, you're talking about situations that I'm not familiar with that weren't brought before a court.
But that's the point. You weren't familiar with them because there's no way you could have gone through the information. You just, to use the word again, dumped it. And after all these years, I'm fascinated to know whether there's a part of you that thinks you got it wrong.
I mean, I don't think I've got it wrong. I think that this information needed to be made public. I think that any method that was made available, I would have taken. There was nothing that was going to stop me. There was no, like, if I didn't have anyone to go to and I was running out of places, I would have done this completely on my own.
In essence, are you saying you don't believe in the legitimacy of intelligence gathering, of secret government activity in the name of national security? Because Michael Rubin, a former Pentagon official, after all of this, particularly the diplomatic cables, which upset him so much, he said, Manning not only burned the sources of hundreds of diplomats around the world, she effectively dissuaded foreigners from ever trusting a future American official.
Well, on the other hand, you have Robert Gates, who basically says that this is nothing. This is a nothing burger. This has no impact on the diplomatic relationship with the United States. This is a Secretary of Defense.
It's not quite what he said. He said, in the end, we will get over this, that outsiders,
right,
foreigners look at the US, they realize these things happen, but they're not going to stop talking to us. But fundamentally, I'm just asking you whether you believe or whether you care that you might have compromised important aspects of US national security and intelligence gathering, not least because, for example, one cable...
Well, for intelligence gathering, I don't think so, because, you know, the US intelligence apparatus is a large apparatus, is one in which, you know, there are many sources and methods. that haven't been made public, that weren't even available to me.
Just a final one on the cables. There was one list of the most important mm-hmm. national security sites around the world listed by U.S. diplomats. And you, of course, you didn't necessarily know you were doing it, but you inadvertently released that to the world, too. P.J. Crowley, the State Department spokesman at the time, said you were effectively giving a targeting list to al-Qaeda. Did that give you pause for thought?
I mean, look, we live in the age of radical transparency already at this
but
point.
But what does that mean, radical
what does that
transparency?
Mean? Well,
it doesn't mean you don't have a personal responsibility, and I'm asking you whether
look,
you
I went
feel
through a court-martial process. I went through a court-martial process where evidence was presented before the court. We were given evidence. We were given discovery. We went through this process. I've taken responsibility. I've taken full responsibility for all of my actions. I've gone through this process.
You did, at the time of the court-martial, let's get to that, you did say that you recognized the damage you had done. So to this day, do you recognize damage done?
Look, my job was essentially to make decisions in which I damaged people every single day. So among all of the decisions that I've ever made in my entire life, yes, I have caused, you know, some harm. I've killed civilians. You know, I've been involved in the death of civilians because I've made mistakes. This was just me doing my job. I was never held accountable.
Well, the leaking clearly wasn't you doing your job because the military then decided...
I'm talking about the job that I was doing, Iraq. I was an intelligence analyst.
I did this every day. I understand that. That was the job.
There are dozens of people not alive today because of the job that I did. And I, you know, and